I'd like now to welcome Paul Johnson. He's a geophysicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and he will be giving a talk tonight titled, Does One Big Earthquake Lead to Another? That's at 7 o'clock at the James A. Little Theater in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Nice to be here, Marie-Charlotte.
So let's just start with basics. What is an earthquake? Are all earthquakes basically of the same nature?
They're not the same nature. Well, fundamentally, I guess you could say they're of the same nature, but they're different geometries, you might say. A fault an earthquake takes place when two fault blocks that are on adjacent sides of a fault zone are stressed or forced differently, and the stress builds up. There's a failure. That is the earthquake itself. It's very much like, and I'll show this in my presentation, if you're pushing a large block across the floor, you lean against the block, you push harder and harder, but it doesn't move. So the force you're pushing on the block with builds up, and it progressively builds up, but eventually the block slips. So it lurches forward. And that's the same idea about what takes place in an earthquake. So this kind of behavior takes place in the earth, but with various geometries. There are many kinds of faults that take place in different kinds of what are known as tectonic or geologic environments. The basic idea is that.
So if you have a block that's on a slick floor, it just slides across. But if you have a lot of friction between the block and the floor, then it will suddenly lurch. Is there variation in the friction between two plates or two blocks, as you call them?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. In fact, what you've described does describe the different kinds of behaviors one gets in the earth. You have different kinds of friction or different levels of friction between different kinds of faults. So you can have sort of this stable sliding that you just described that does take place. And this produces very specific kinds of small earthquakes, or even tremor as it's known, that was discovered about 15 years ago in Southern California and in Japan. But an actual earthquake takes place when you have buildup on stress and there's a slip of that block. And the more you have to push, and the more the stress builds up leading to that slip, the larger the earthquake is. So you've kind of described the two spectra of earthquakes, the end members, this stable sliding as the block just slips across the floor versus the stress building up and eventually the block slips abruptly.
How did we get these plates that are pressuring each other in the first place?
Well, that's a relatively long story, but let's try to make it brief. What happens is there's an engine, as we'll call it, that drives this whole system that takes place in the Earth's mantle, below the Earth's crust, well below our feet. This is due to thermal convection currents that rise up from the deep mantle. They encounter the Earth's surface. They spread across the Earth's surface, beneath the Earth's surface, and then are convected back downward as they cool. So this kind of convection cell, as it's called, couples to the Earth's plates, which are literally floating on top of the Earth's surface. So this coupling drives the plates, and as a result of that, the plates are interacting with each other. In some places, friction is building up. They're stuck, and eventually they fail. In other places, they're sliding slowly past each other in the way you just described. So this is fundamentally what drives the plate tectonics of the Earth, which leads to faulting, the plate tectonics being the movement of these plates floating across the Earth's surface, driven by this convection, this thermal convection that applies forces to the base of these plates.
So all of this is the work that geologists do, that geophysicists like you do, and are the plates and the fault lines all over the Earth, are they well understood at this point?
Yes and no. they're identified, and they have been for a number of years. There was sort of a revolution in geosciences in the 1960s when this theory of plate tectonics was actually demonstrated. And since that time, I think there's a fairly profound advance. There is a profound advance in understanding of the geology and tectonics of the Earth. In addition, we have tremendous imaging tools to understand the Earth's interior from seismology and from other geophysical tools. So they're understood in regards to where they're located, the type of fault they are, and actually characterized in the sense of how the stresses may be building up on them and eventually make them fail. What's not understood are the physical details inside the fault and how that controls and how an earthquake may take place. That's an area that's being explored in a fairly large manner now by many, many different laboratories. And we're one of the laboratories working on understanding faulting and understanding this process of earthquake interaction that I'll talk a bit about tonight.
To what extent are earthquakes predictable, and with what level of precision, if any?
Again, that's a tough question, but it's the billion-dollar question right now in geoscience. Can you predict an earthquake? The answer is not in my lifetime, and perhaps never. But there are many things you can do in terms of characterizing when an earthquake might take place, some time interval. That time interval might be many years, but based on evidence suggesting there's stress building up and you might be approaching a state where you could have the earthquake, there's a lot of advancement there that's taken place in the last 10 or 15 years. There's also something that's being developed and has been being developed over the last 10 years regarding real-time earthquake, not prediction, but warning. So in other words, the idea is an earthquake takes place and you have warning in the region to tell you that the damaging seismic waves will arrive soon, to take shelter, take action. So you might have 30 seconds or a minute or a few minutes before that arrives, before the seismic waves arrive.
Does 30 seconds actually make a difference?
It does, because if you're trained to get into a safe place, the answer is yes. You could get into a place where you have less risk of getting hurt. There's also the same kind of system in development for tsunami, these large waves that travel across the earth following a large earthquake that takes place in a subduction zone. So these developments are taking place at the same time with the same idea in mind. Let people have some warning to get to a safe place.
So how many earthquakes happen a year? I mean, I guess there are gazillions of small ones and very few large ones, but what are we looking at in, for example, the United States? What are we looking at in New Mexico?
New Mexico has fairly low seismic risk. I'm going to show a map tonight illustrating how low the seismic risk is. When you compare it with Alaska or California or the state of Washington, we have very, very low seismic risk. So globally, there are something like 1 magnitude 8 or larger a year. These are really rare, relatively rare events. But if you drop down to magnitude 2, 1 to 2, there are many more than a million a year. So you have a huge spectrum in the number of earthquakes that take place depending on their magnitude or how much energy they release. The magnitude is a measure, or the moment magnitude as it's called, is a measure of how much energy is released in the event. And those numbers correspond to the amount of energy released.
Is there any human activity that engenders earthquakes or makes earthquakes happen?
The answer is yes, and that's been well demonstrated since the 60s, in fact, and probably before, by experiments that were conducted by not only the military, the Army, but also by the United States Geological Survey. And now we have this very large experiment taking place in regards to hydraulic fracturing and the injection of the waste fluids associated with that. Not just fracking, I should add. I mean, that fr- fracking is relatively new in regards to gas shales and what you hear in the news over the last 10 years. But this kind of wastewater injection has been taking place for 50 or 60 years from conventional oil production.
And that causes earthquakes?
It can. It doesn't always, and it can. And that injection process causes buildup in pressure. Imagine this. You drill a hole deep into the earth. You force fluids down into that hole. That's what the idea of injecting wastewater is. Let's get rid of the wastewater. Let's go well below the water table, down several miles into the crust, a mile or more. We'll pump fluids and we'll get rid of them. But you can imagine that you're increasing the fluid pressure at those depths. And increasing the fluid pressure means that if you intersect existing faults, and there are lots of faults spread across the planet, you could, in fact, make that fault slip if it is in the right condition.
To what extent has that been studied with respect to this technique that you're talking about?
Studies right now are really ramping up in this area because there's so much public concern about these fracking-related or fluid injection-related earthquakes. So a lot is being learned very quickly. A lot was known previous to the last 10 years, but right now I think is the time when there's a lot of seismologists spending a lot of time trying to understand this behavior.
What do earthquake scientists like yourself do in the lab, and what do you do in the field? Like, what are your days like? What are your lives like?
Well, it's different for different people. I mean, some seismologists, and I'm not really a seismologist. I do a bit of seismology. But they spend their days looking at seismic data, or in fact even going out and placing seismic instruments. I have a colleague that does that at Los Alamos. Many of them, though, have access to data sets that are collected daily worldwide, and they're posted online and you can just download them. So they spend their days downloading and analyzing these kinds of seismic data, the earthquake data, the depth, the time, and they analyze these data to answer various questions. What we do is conduct many laboratory studies. So we do a bit of this data analysis I've just described, but the other half of what we do is conduct laboratory experiments, some of them at Penn State University, some in Paris, some at Los Alamos, to try to understand faulting from laboratory experiments and also to understand this question of earthquake interaction, which I imagine we're going to get to.
So let's talk about that right now, earthquake interaction. Does one big earthquake, that's the title of your talk tonight, does one big earthquake actually lead to another?
So the answer is yes. There's lots of evidence that tells us that this kind of behavior takes place, and what Mary Charlotte, you're suggesting is that you have an earthquake that takes place on one place on the planet, waves propagate out across the planet, and maybe hundreds of miles away, maybe even thousands of miles away, you trigger another earthquake. There are many, many earthquakes triggered in what's known as the aftershock zone after a large earthquake, right around the large earthquake. That's a phenomenon that's very well known. And that's due primarily to static stress changes and possibly the effect of dynamic waves, the seismic waves interacting with this region as well. But at large distances, it can only be seismic waves that cause this. So that's well established. The question of today is really, do very large earthquakes trigger very large earthquakes? And that's a question that a lot of people have been tackling over the last 5 years, including our group and our collaborators.
So what have you come up with so far?
Well, we have found, along with other people as well, that there's just not sufficient data. This is my own opinion. I would think if you talk to other people working on this problem, they'd say, well, we think this is solved. There isn't earthquake interaction. But what we've discovered is that depending on the statistical method you use, you come up with different answers. And all of these answers are sort of middle of the road, which is to say, it's difficult to tell yes or no. And I argue that, and I will tonight argue that, it's because we don't have a very large data set. We've only been collecting quality seismic data for about 50 years, and the seismic record only goes back about 100 years.
And these very big earthquakes are relatively rare compared to the small ones.
Exactly. If you only have one magnitude 8 a year, well, you've got 100 over the last 100 years or so. And magnitude 9s even more infrequent. So it's very difficult to tease out whether or not they're interacting. It's tantalizing to look at the data because there are these groupings of large earthquakes. There have been over the last 15 years. There was a grouping like this in the mid-century, last century, the 1950s and 60s. But you'd go out on a limb to say that they're actually connected. We just don't know right now. And considering how sparse the data are, the lack of the number of earthquakes that exist, I don't know that we'll ever know.
Have you ever been in an earthquake? Have you experienced that firsthand?
I have. The biggest earthquake I was sat through or lived through was in the Gulf of Corinth when I was young. This was in 1980, I believe. And that was probably about a magnitude 6.5 approximately. I was in Sparta, and it was during the night, and that was quite a ride.
What was it like?
Well, I think it's like it is for anybody that experiences it. You start to feel this shaking. You're not sure if it's you initially, but as the larger amplitude seismic waves arrive, you realize, wow, this is an earthquake. And it can last a long time. It feels like an eternity. As you sit through the arrival of the seismic waves, primarily surface waves, as they're called. In fact, I think it lasted probably 30 seconds, something like that, but it felt like many minutes. I was interested because I was studying seismology, and I thought it was pretty cool. My wife was terrified, I'll say.
And you weren't?
I wasn't terrified, but I also had a vicious flu. And so I didn't want to get out of bed, and we were in a small hotel in Sparta. So everybody else went out onto the streets and lit bonfires, and I swore I wasn't going to get out. I thought, if the building collapses, it's okay. I was so sick.
Now, were you there studying earthquakes? Did you know that this was a possibility?
No, I wasn't. We were actually on a trip around the world, and we just happened to be there at the right time.
Does it affect the work you do now that you have had that experience at all?
I think it helped guide me into it. I had done some seismology. I'd been studying geophysics. But I think having experienced it did turn me more in that direction. I was quite excited by it.
So it seems like an earthquake is the ultimate nature is bigger than we are kind of experience. It's something beyond our control. It's something that we can try to study and understand, but there's not much that we can do about earthquakes. Or is there? I mean, is there any way to build buildings or do human communities with respect to earthquakes so that we are not as badly affected by them?
Yeah, there are many things one can do. You can move to a place like New Mexico where you have very few earthquakes. And not even consider it. But if you live in a place like California or Japan or Seattle, where earthquakes are very common, one can do many things. Engineers and scientists design and build structures that are earthquake proof, and you'll see them if you go to these areas. There's also things one can do if you're just an individual. And that is, a wooden house is a great place to be in an earthquake, as opposed to a brick house, for example, or a well-engineered building.
Why is a wooden house better than a brick house?
Because you can imagine it gives as seismic waves hit it, and it's deformed. It will deform as opposed to just fall down, which is what a brick structure might do. The other thing that one can do is not live right on a fault. Although in places like California that can be challenging, but also to live on a site that's built of hard rock, that the geologic formation there is hard rock at the earth's surface as opposed to sediments. because sediments do a great job of allowing more shaking to take place than the adjacent rock might. So this is something I would think about if I ever moved to California.
So tell us more about, before we go, about the kinds of laboratory experiments that you've been involved with.
So I work with an individual named Chris Marone. He's a professor at Penn State, and he's designed and built what I call the earthquake machine, which is a machine that shears blocks together, much in the way we talked about earlier, where you're pushing a block across the floor. In this case, a piston pushes a block downward past another block, and there's material between the two blocks that's called fault gouge. That's just the material that is contained in most faults and builds up over time as you have each individual earthquake take place. There's a crushing and grinding of that material, so you produce this gouge material between the two fault blocks. So we have a system that looks like that in the laboratory, scaled down to probably 10 inches by 10 inches by 10 inches in diameter. And what one can do is put this in the earthquake machine. You drive it with this piston. The blocks begin to slide. They stick slip and create earthquakes in the laboratory. Then, once we've got the earthquakes going in this system, we apply sound waves. The analogy is triggering seismic waves that we see in the earth that trigger distant earthquakes. So we mimic that with a speaker that's mounted on this block system that applies sound to the system and perturbs the whole system in some manner. What we're able to do is trigger earthquakes in that earthquake machine. We were pretty astonished at first when we were able to see this, and also we saw very strange effects, very unexpected effects that lasted a long time after we applied the sound waves that we understand much better now, but play, we think, a really key role in a lot of the observations in the earth. What's interesting when you have a triggered earthquake in the earth is that it can be delayed. So the seismic wave sweeps through some area, and you don't have instantaneous triggering. The triggering takes place minutes, hours, days, weeks, potentially even months afterwards. That's hard to understand. Triggering itself is hard enough to understand, but this delayed triggering is even harder to understand. So we think we understand delayed triggering now in a much, much more quantitative manner, and I think we've shed insight, or we've provided some insight into what may be taking place in processes in the earth.
Paul Johnson is a geophysicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Once again, he will be giving a talk tonight titled, Does One Big Earthquake Lead to Another? That's at 7 o'clock at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe. It's free and open to the public. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.